Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, I'm James Randerson, and thank you for downloading Science Extra. This is our exclusive interview with Professor Steve Jones, a geneticist at UCL and a man who's been described as the Alan Bennett of science writing. I began by asking him what was the thinking behind his new book, Coral, A Pessimist in Paradise.
I am that very rare thing. It was an honest plagiarist. And my last two books, or two of my most recent books, have been straightforward plagiarism of Charles Darwin. The first one, I plagiarised The Origin of Species, almost like a whale. And then Why, The Descent of Men, stolen from Darwin's book of almost the same title. And Darwin wrote 19 books altogether, and his very first one was called Coral Reefs. So I thought, well, no, I actually knew a bit about coral because I'd done a degree in zoology, a very classically oriented one, and spent quite a long time studying polyps and the like. So I rather blithely thought, oh, I'll write a book about coral reefs. And after about, I did a lot of reading. I did slightly despair after about a month's hard reading because it was all about, you know, the collapse of the ecosystem and global warming and boring stuff like that. But then as you dig away at it, it turns out, and I was quite surprised really, it turns out that coral animals are fascinating in their own right in many different ways. For example, I hadn't known that stem cells were discovered 200 years ago, in effect, among freshwater relatives of corals. That corals were at the very beginning of the study of symbiosis, that's the interaction of different creatures together in what seems like a harmonious association, but isn't.
And at that stage, you bring in Karl Marx as well.
Well, that's the other odd thing, and it is odd, and it's unexpected, that many people have turned to the reefs for sort of lessons of different kinds over the years. I mean, you see that today, as I said in my talk. I mean, Desert Island Discs is no mistake, set on a desert island, a coral reef. And it's this notion of a paradise which is very attractive. And Marx used it, he picked it up from a Russian anarchist called Kropotkin. And Kropotkin had come up with the idea of mutualism. There's Patrice Geddes, who was an Edinburgh, called the Professor of Things in General in Edinburgh, and was a philosopher and political thinker, planned the street plan of Tel Aviv and so on, discovered the coral symbiosis. And so there are all kinds of most unlikely characters who come into this. Some of them a bit more likely, people like James Cook, who was, you know, a deeply fascinating character, a man about whom I had known rather little. So it sort of happened that way. It was a late flowering book. I mean, it took a long time to get it going. I read a review of it somewhere which said, this book needs an editor. It just hops around from place to place. It hasn't, you know, it's like Winston Churchill's putting it, lacks a theme. I can see that criticism has some weight. But to me, it has a theme, because it all turns on coral. But of course, being an evolutionist, you should be able to explain most of biology from any group of creatures that you look at, because the same processes apply to all of them, be they bananas or be they human beings. And corals show the triumph of that mindset, absolutely.
The tagline, of course, is a pessimist in paradise, and you say that all scientists are essentially pessimists. Why is that?
I think it's, I kind of mean that. I mean, I suppose I mean, what do I mean? I do mean pessimists or cynics, people who are trained not to believe. Or prefer not to believe, I think. And they, you know, I'm a bit of a Popperian here. That what you do is to go out and try and disprove hypotheses, and that all hypotheses are potentially disprovable, and that makes you profoundly cynical about every paper you read. I mean, you're looking for faults in it. Generally, you don't find them, but if you do find them, then it's a great Schadenfreude is had. I mean, I'm occasionally attacked for saying, you know, why should we listen to you about evolution? Because you believe in evolution. And it's a bit of a portmanteau word, belief. But, of course, if I were able to prove that evolution had not happened, or that Darwin's theory of natural selection would not do the job, I would be infinitely famous among my colleagues. I would be absolutely delighted. I get a Nobel Prize, I start learning Swedish tomorrow. But of course, so far, nobody has managed to do it, which doesn't mean to say it couldn't happen someday, but it hasn't happened yet.
You mentioned that when you started researching the book, you sort of encountered these tales of woe about the death of coral reefs, and the book itself is full of many kind of human disasters as well on these islands. Perhaps you could tell us a bit about some of those.
It's a strange thing. I mean, I think what people look for in paradise is a sense of order. That's what they need. That's what people, of course, look for in religion. They want something which is unchanging and fixed, which they don't have to constantly be on guard against. And the irony is that any attempt to find it in the coral islands of the tropics is doomed to fail, because these places are actually very risky places to live. They're small, they're isolated, and that has dangers of its own. The famous example of that arises, of course, from the spread of the disease. When Captain Cook got to Tahiti for the first time, just 1 year after de Bougainville, the French explorer, Tahiti was sexually very open. And Captain Cook noted the amazing health of the people. That was his first visit. His second,
not for much longer.
Not for much longer. By the time of his second visit, there was this terrible disease, and we're not sure what it was. It was a venereal disease of some kind. It might have been syphilis. But it was beginning to kill the population off in huge numbers. And I was startled to find that all over the Pacific, the populations living on the islands today, in a world that we see as an overcrowded world, is less, in most places, than it was before Captain Cook. So, you know, not much optimism there.
Yeah, the human damage, as great if not more so than the sort of damage to species that we've done on those islands. Yeah. There was a slightly kind of hostile question that part of your response to it, you predicted that civilization or the downfall of civilization could be brought about by religion. And what did you mean by that?
Well, that was I do somewhat believe that, I have to say. I mean, my question, which I did not mean to sound hostile, but it was a fairly, as you say, it was a fairly hostile question. And again, it's a fairly standard response. It was a chap, no doubt a charming, pleasant fellow, he seemed to be, who was a vicar of some kind or a curate. And the argument is there are a number of delightful and honest people who are religious, and I don't deny that for a moment. And there are a number of scientists who are religious, and that of course is true. So why can't they just rub along together? And my answer was really, well, if only they could, but they can't. I mean, I spend my time fighting off attacks by religions on science. And when you find back, it turns out that religion is a terribly shrinking plant. It screams, it doesn't like it, you know, and if it really doesn't like it, it'll probably kill you. I have a lot of admiration for Richard Dawkins, not just because of his writings, which I like. Well, I wish he didn't sell quite as many copies, but that's a separate issue. Because I think he's a genuinely brave person. I mean, he goes and he talks to large audiences in Alabama, and he is taking risks. And I think that's something laudable. I didn't mean to be, perhaps, to be quite as outspoken in my attack on the world of religion, but that's what I think. I have less trouble with religion than I do with religions. Mm-hmm. There was only one, it mightn't be so bad. Mm. But it's almost the nature of religion that it needs to exclude people. And once you start excluding people, you're in trouble.
But what do you mean by it being able to bring about the end of civilization? Because many people would probably argue that, you know, religion and the paraphernalia that surrounds religion has contributed a lot to civilization.
Here's a pompous statement. I've just finished reading, it took a long time, Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, which is a remarkably good book, long, needs an editor, but it is a remarkably good book. And Gibbon, very daringly for his day, made a very clear case that what destroyed the Roman Empire was the growth of Christianity. Okay. Now, one might argue, and I think it's undeniable that that's true, and one might argue, and I would argue, that in those days the religion of Christianity was actually a rather kinder religion than the Roman gods, but it subverted an empire. I saw him here in just a few minutes ago. I went to a lecture at the Royal Society the other week by somebody who often writes in The Guardian. I probably get his name wrong. Zaidin Zahar, is it Shah? And he's clearly a very religious man. And he gave a lecture at the Royal about science in the Islamic world. That was fascinating. It was very good. And the tenor of his lecture could be summarized in three words. There isn't any. Okay? There's none. You go across the Islamic world, effectively, with the exception of Turkey, where there's some good scientists, effectively, there's none. There's some engineers, there's doctors, but regards science, it doesn't exist in some of the most affluent countries in the world. And the reason for that is clear, that religion there has established itself so firmly that there is no room for science, because science must cast doubts upon religious beliefs. Mm. And if there's no room for science, or no room for many other things, it's very hard for a scientist not to be aggressive about the spread of religion. And I think it's reasonable for people to point out the lesson from history, that the wars, the clashes of religions, have led to the overthrow of many civilizations, and I would say are likely to do so again.
Well, I guess that fact kind of gives the lie to this cosy idea of non-overlapping magisteria, these spheres of influence that science and religion have, and they can cosily sit next to each other without harming each other.
I mean, if Steve Gould, that was his phrase, of course, I mean, as he preached from his Olympus of Orotundity, that was one that he came up with. I would say, you know, non-overlapping magisteria, if only. Okay. I don't think anybody in the world of science, even Dawkins, would suggest that science could disprove the existence of God. I mean, if you read Richard's book, in the end he admits it can't. And so we say, okay, that's not our territory. I mean, science can perhaps come up with some adaptive explanation as to why people need to believe these things, but that's a separate issue. But religion, of course, can disprove science again and again and again, or so it thinks, and so it keeps trying. So if they non-overlap our magisterium, we non-overlap theirs, but they show no sign of it.
Just finally, to come back, you mentioned you had this analogy of religion as this sort of spiteful plant that will hurt you if you're nasty to it. A.C. Grayling put forward the idea that religion is actually in its death throes, and that's why there is this very bad-tempered debate between rationalism and religion at the moment, and also perhaps would explain some of the kind of fundamentalism and extremism we see. Do you think that might be the case?
Well, A.C. My book is called A Pessimist in Paradise, and A.C. Grayling is clearly an optimist in hell. No, I'm not nearly as sanguine as he is. I mean, I think religion, if it is in its death throes, that's about one of its most dangerous moments. I don't think so. I mean, my observation among my UCL students, who are generally a very fine lot, a very mixed group of people, religion is catching on as syphilis did in the Pacific after the arrival of Captain Cook. So I don't see it as being in its death throes, if only it was.
That was Professor Steve Jones. To hear more interviews like that, and to hear the latest analysis of this week's science news, go to the Science Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/science/podcasts.
Guardian Unlimited.